it's a big buy-in thing to make sure that this podcast is not just basic farm and physiology.
I think what we do is, even with short answer questions that are a little bit dry, what we'll try to do is we'll try to make it relevant to our anesthetic practices.
So yeah, let's keep it as clinical as possible, make the first part interesting. And yeah, let's go to the intro. Hi everyone, and welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break.
I'm Stan. Oh, sorry. Look, you changed that because...
I did not change it.
No. It's always... Oh, yes. I'm Lahiru and I'm Stan. So now you've... It must be a 2021 thing you're doing here. You've tricked me right from the start. All right.
Okay. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Anesthesia Coffee Break.
I'm Stan.
And I'm Lahiru. And today we are talking about the effects of pregnancy on the respiratory system. But first, Stan, what's your performance tip for today?
Thanks, La, and Happy New Year to you and to everyone out there. And the idea that I want to talk about today is flexibility. So you need to be flexible with this exam. And the reason for this is that you have to think about it in terms of the time of your life where you're sitting this exam. So you're sitting this exam when you've got a full-time job. It's very unlike the exams you've set in high school or in university, where you've got a very set time where you're in school or in university, and you can create a very set time of when you can study. The difficulty with this exam is that when you have a full-time job, and most people have full-times and part-time jobs, you'll have a set amount of time where you're at work. And the problem is that it changes because of shift work. We do shift work. So we do a lot of on-calls. And also we all do different rotations as well. So one of the problems that a lot of trainees talk to me about is being on a country rotation. And that creates that idea that it is a hamper to their ability to pass this exam.
Yep.
What I can tell you is that if you are flexible and if you believe that it's not a problem, it's not a problem.
Yep.
If you believe that it is a problem, it is going to be a problem. So you need to be flexible in this exam, and you need to be able to sort of change the way that you study. And also, even though you've got an overall plan in terms of how you would like to study, you need to adapt that to certain changes. So sometimes you may get called in to do an extra shift, and you've gone, look, I've got my study time here. You need to be able to go, look, I will make it up another time.
Do you remember that you did anything particular to manage the really crazy shift work and the weird hours, and the fact that often we're just doing evening after evening or night after night when we're a trainee, as opposed to as a consultant where you have a lot of days?
So what I would do is I'd have an overall plan in terms of what I like to achieve each week and in terms of the topics that you want to cover. But I'd only plan how I would study probably just the week before. So in terms of day by day, I would look at my schedule and go, look, I want to achieve this at this point in time. So I'd never try to look for more forward for more than a week in advance.
Yeah, okay. I did something similar, I think, where I realized that this was going to be difficult. If I could get an evening shift, I knew I studied best in the morning. I wanted to give the best hours to myself. So if anyone wanted to swap an evening, I'd definitely swap to the evening at the expense of, you know, getting a social life back. But the other thing was, I knew that I couldn't really do short answers at work. So I'd always prep myself to have conversations at work and do lots of MCQs. MCQs just take less kind of thought process. It's more like repetition and that kind of thing. So I could easily just do it during a long case. So MCQs, have all my papers ready, have a little, you know, I had a format paper with 150 questions that I could just kind of mark off and circle. And that was really useful for just getting lots done. And if I just did a few papers, which was done quickly, that was my task done for the day. And then I had an ICU rotation where I was on transport. And that's a weird job where all you're doing is transporting patients that need MRIs and CTs. And it can be a very boring job and a bit scary at times. But on that roster, all I did was write out my pharmacology tables. Because again, I didn't have to work too hard. I could still focus on the job.
Yes.
And I was just writing out the rote learning. Yep.
Perfect. And that's the whole idea. You got to be flexible. You got to adapt to your work, adapt to the hours that you do. So never miss out an opportunity to do some study. So
yeah, that's right.
If you have extra time and you have a consultant that's willing to teach you or to give you a short answer question, do it.
Yep.
Never miss out an opportunity. Always remain flexible. And I always think about the exam, not just as a pure science exam, but it's also an exam of life. And I know I'm being
No, no, go for it.
Holistic here, but it's just the idea that as you become a consultant, you need to be able to manage all these different stresses, and the strategies that you learn trying to pass the part one exam, they'll hold you in good stead for life. Everything that, that you decide to do in terms of planning for the exam, being flexible, being adaptable, these are all really good things. And we'll talk about more of these things, you know, in later podcasts.
But I really like that. So flexibility. So continuing with the this question. Question three from the 2019 Feb-March paper is, discuss the effects of pregnancy on the respiratory system that are relevant to the practice of anesthesia. Include in your answer how these effects influence the conduct of anesthesia. So what's your structure and summary statement for this, do you reckon? How would you approach this?
So this is where the college is moving towards to in terms of how they structure their answers or how they create their answers, how they create their questions. So they're trying to create questions which are what we call understanding questions. And this is where it is so important to have that background in terms of your knowledge and be able to put in clinical aspects to it. And that's the hard thing. As a first year trainee, sometimes you don't have that clinical background to actually put into your clinical knowledge or into, sorry, the science knowledge. And that's where being able to think about all these concepts at work really helps you solidify your knowledge. So the way that I would think about this question is I'd create a summary statement where I would go respiratory changes during pregnancy affects one, the airway management, two, pre-oxygenation, three, ventilation, four, lung mechanics, five, uptake of inhalational agents.
For airway management, how would you approach this? What are the issues?
With regards to airway management, there's an increase in estrogen, which increases fluid retention, and that increases the swelling and friability of your nasopharyngeal and oropharyngeal airways. And theoretically, there is an increased risk of airway trauma. So when you go to intubate a patient and you put in your blade, if you're a little bit rough, what you'll find is that you might find that there's a little bit more bleeding with the airway tissues. The other thing to note is that also with the enlarged breasts, that if you don't actually have them in the ramp position, you can make intubation difficult. And that's where they create things like the short handles for pregnancy. But I think the most important thing is, and as I tell all the registrars, if you have a pregnant patient who you think is going to be a difficult intubation for an elective cesarean, always have them in the intubating position.
Yep, absolutely. I completely agree. And it's almost interesting to see that every single pregnant patient, like you said, they have the enlarged breast, but also the increased gestational weight. They just look like a terrible intubation when they're lying there having their seizure. And you just feel uncomfortable thinking, oh, you know, this spinal is working. But if it didn't work, if something happened, what would I do?
Yes. And there's many times when you go into theater and there's this big pregnant patient lying flat down, their breast up to their chin, and spinal is working well, but if they need it to be intubated for whatever reason, it is going to be difficult. And I can tell you a couple of stories of consultants who get themselves into trouble when this happens because it's so rare. I think sometimes we take it for granted that everything's going well, but when something doesn't go well and the patient needs to be intubated rapidly, often good to have these patients in the appropriate position.
Yeah, and I just remember reading some incredible data on the increased risk of failed airways. And this data was incredible, you know, like 1 in 300 difficult intubations or something like that, which is drastically higher than the maybe 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 rate normally that occurs. But more recent data shows that the chance of a can't intubate, can't oxygenate patient is much, much less. And I think the early research, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was a large proportion of junior doctors in the UK who often doing these cases overnight, they're unprepared, they're uncertain, they're unsupervised. Essentially, they're junior doctors who haven't had this kind of understanding of what you need to do. And in practice, I think these patients are often, you know, you have to be as cautious with them as any other high BMI patient with a high metabolic rate. You know, it's just a difficult situation. And, you know, what is it? They're having the spinal, everything's going well. Suddenly you need to jump into action.
Yes.
And I think now we're seeing there's more awareness of that. So the rates, the more recent data, I think on the, there's triennial reports in the UK, the CMS reports show that the rates of CICO are far less than we thought they were. And I believe this is because of better preparation. Like we're talking
about. And look, I'm not surprised at all. And it just goes back to the idea that you only know what you know. And if you've never experienced having to manage a pregnant patient airway who is lying flat, you don't actually appreciate how difficult it is. But trust me, once it happens, you will always make sure that you change your practice to ensure that you optimize the airway. And there's nothing better than life experiences. But the problem with this is that with this life experience, you've got a life in your hands. So that's why it's often to actually think about these things before.
That's good. So just to recap, that's airway management. And I really like the sequence of steps you put there. Estrogen, increased fluid retention, increased swelling. And that's what leads to this increase of airway trauma, as well as the enlarged patient size and enlarged breast for the increased risk of difficult intubation. So that's the airway. The next point is preoxygenation. So tell me about that.
So with preoxygenation, you've got the gravid uterus at term, which decreases your functional residual capacity by 20% in the upright position and 30% in the supine position. So with the supine position, what happens is that with the reduction in FRC, that approaches closing capacity, or it actually becomes even less than closing capacity, leading to airway closure. And when you get airway closure, you get shunt. So what that means is that you actually reduce your safe apnea time despite good preoxygenation.
And just quickly, just for the listeners, what is shunt? What's the definition of that?
So shunt is blood that moves from the right to the left side of the heart without participating in gas exchange.
Fantastic. So yeah, hypoxemic, one of the causes of hypoxemia.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do in practice then to mitigate this risk?
You really need to ensure good preoxygenation. Mm-hmm. So good head up positioning to minimize the supine position. And you can't think of other things such as OptiFlow. I think people use PSV Pro. You've got a YouTube video on this, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. At my channel, ABCs of Anesthesia, I've just shown one of the techniques is to just put the mask on and get even the patient to hold it so it's comfortable, and just put a pressure support mode like PSV Pro with only 5 centimeters of pressure, turn up the flows to 15 liters per minute of oxygen, and you get, you know, in 4 breaths, you'll have an end tidal of 80%, and you can get even up to 90% after about 10 breaths. So just a really quick way of getting preoxygenation, which I love to do in any kind of larger patient.
Fantastic. And if they want to have a look at this video, you'll have this YouTube link on
the podcast. Right. Any of these, I'll put in the story notes.
Fantastic.
Good. So that's the airway, and that's preoxygenation. And I really love that you had actual numbers there. I think numbers and precision does impress the examiners.
And with the numbers, I know it's hard to remember numbers sometimes. So I always try to just round them off. Like, you don't need to be perfect with numbers, but it does need to be approximately correct. And you'll see with my other numbers that I will write about in the next topic, I try to create the numbers. And I'll show you how I sort of think about them and how I do it so that there's a pattern to them. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Excellent. So that's the airway and preoxygenation. How about ventilation?
So with ventilation, progesterone increases by 6 times, and this leads to an increase in sensitization of the central chemoreceptors. There's a 3 times increase in the slope of the CO2 ventilation response curve, and there's a 2 times increase in the hypoxic ventilatory response curve, leading to a 40 to 50% increase in the minute ventilation by third trimester. And most of that is actually driven by the increase in tidal volume, as the respiratory rate actually remains unchanged.
That's really interesting. So just to recap that, so a 6 times increase in progesterone increases sensitization of the central chemoreceptors, then a 3 times increase in the slope of the CO2 ventilatory response curve, and 2 times increase in the hypoxic ventilatory response curve. Okay, great.
Great. And as you can see with the numbers, the way that I remember it is 6, which is 3 times 2. So 3 is the increase in the PCO2 ventilation response curve, and 2 is the hypoxic ventilatory response curve. Leads to a 50%. And look, you can just use 50% increase in mid ventilation.
I love that. You can follow these numbers and it's got a pattern to it. And it's 6, all about 3 pattern.
3 to 50%.
Lovely. Yes.
And the benefit of increasing your mid ventilation in pregnancy is that it reduces your arterial CO2 in the mother to facilitate CO2 clearance from the fetus. Mm-hmm. And it also increases your arterial oxygen to facilitate oxygen delivery to the fetus.
Beautiful. So the way
that it affects your clinical practice is that if you have a pregnancy patient who's ventilated, you need to ensure that you've got the appropriate minute ventilation. So in a normal patient, I would normally run them at 500 mils of tidal volume and a rest rate of, let's say, 10 to 12. Mm-hmm. in a pregnant patient for the same height, for the same sort of weight, I would increase that tidal volume to 550 or 600 and have their respiratory rate around 12 to 14. And the benefit of that is that you want to ensure that you've got the correct PaO2 and PaCO2 levels. Mm-hmm. And it's also important to avoid excessive hyperventilation, as if you do cause a respiratory alkalosis, this can cause a left shift of your hemoglobin oxygen dissociation curve and subsequently reduce, theoretically, oxygen transfer to the fetus.
And because we're not routinely measuring our PaCO2 levels with ventilation, we're really just going on the end tidal CO2, what number do you aim at? Understand that there's probably more VQ mismatch in these pregnant patients as well.
So I would normally aim for around 30 to 32.
Okay,
and,
yep.
And the reason for that is that, yes, you would sort of think that with regards to VQ mismatch that you may see a difference in your end tidal and arterial O2. But remember that any difference in end tidal and arterial O2 is actually not due to VQ mismatch, but actually due to alveolar dead space.
Yes.
And with the pregnant patient, as long as you have an appropriate blood pressure, they don't tend to have that much alveolar dead space. So if you actually were to check a gas in an intubated pregnant patient who's otherwise healthy, their arterial CO2 should be very close to the end tidal CO2.
Yep.
So I would normally have their end tidal CO2 around 32.
Yes.
30 to 32. I probably wouldn't go less than 30 unless they've got some kind of pathology, and then unless you can confirm with an arterial blood gas that they've got a alveolar arterial gap.
Yeah, and when I think about this normal practice, I think of a 5 gap between end tidal CO2 and PaCO2. So in these pregnant patients, unless they're having seriously high PEEP or suffering great blood loss, you're not going to get that West Zone 1 dead space, really.
Correct.
That's great. So we've just then talked about airway issues, pre-oxygenation, and ventilation. Tell me about lung mechanics.
So with lung mechanics, there's no change in lung compliance, but there is a reduction in chest wall compliance from the increase in abdominal contents, as well as the enlarged breasts, and that reduces total respiratory lung compliance. So what you'll see is that you'll see increased inspiratory pressures are needed for a given tidal volume.
And just to clarify, so you know, total compliance, which we'll go through in the next episode, is composed of lung itself and then the chest wall. So lung compliance is essentially unchanged, but then the chest wall compliance changed. And that makes a lot of inherent sense.
Correct. And this is a source of confusion for many candidates. And we'll talk about this in the next podcast.
Yes.
Where there needs to be a distinction between total respiratory lung compliance and lung compliance.
Yes.
And why there's a source of confusion is because a lot of textbooks, when they talk about lung compliance, they often mean total respiratory lung compliance.
Yeah.
And it's only in the true physiology textbooks like West, where when they talk about lung compliance, they mean lung compliance.
Lung tissue, yeah.
Lung tissue compliance, correct. And not chest wall compliance. But for us, as anaesthetists, I think that total respiratory lung compliance is a lot more clinically relevant to us.
So it does matter. So with this decreasing lung compliance, it makes a difference in terms of we will potentially generate high ventilating pressures in the anaesthetized intubated patient, but also if the patient has a spinal and they're lying flat, they will have a higher work of breathing as well.
Yes, yeah. Correct.
Okay, good. So those are the first four. Finally, the uptake of inhalational agents. Tell me about that.
Look, this is probably a bonus point because it probably isn't that clinically relevant, but there is theoretical aspects to it. So you have an increase in your alveolar ventilation FRC ratio. So what that means is that with your increase in alveolar ventilation you get from pregnancy, and with the reduction in FRC you get from the gravid uterus in pregnancy, you get an increase in transfer of volatile from machine to alveoli because less of it is being stored in your FRC.
Yep.
And what that means is that you get an increase in rise in your FA, FI curve. And so what should theoretically happen is that changes to volatile concentration should happen quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. And that would mean that depth of anesthesia may occur quite rapidly with changes in volatile agents.
Yeah, and I agree that this is just something that the examiners often talk about, and you see it invoked in many textbooks and notes as well. So obviously very relevant in the culture of our practice, in the culture of this exam. But when I think about it, you know, when would I ever do a spont vent induction on a pregnant patient? Therefore, how clinically relevant is this?
Well, I think where it is relevant is that if you had to do a GA cesium and you had to intubate a patient and put them on sevoflurane, and if you don't have end tidal control and you are dialing in fraction inspired concentration at 3 or 4%
yes.
at whatever flow rate,
yes.
that you may see them reach that a lot quicker than you would otherwise.
And, of course. And but even though your alveolar ventilation is what you've made it, your FRC is less, so it would increase the FA.
Yeah, that's right. And remember that with regards to the previous point I made about ventilation, you are also changing your ventilatory settings to increase your minute ventilation in these patients. So you are theoretically increasing the delivery of volatile agents for someone who you've given a GA cesium to.
Sounds good. I can imagine a really specific circumstance maybe that you've got a patient with a difficult airway or some kind of epiglottitis and is pregnant, and then you do a spont vent induction. You can imagine that this could be one of those really rare situations. Jeez. And you'll think back to this podcast and go, oh, they're gonna reach their FA, FI curve plateau very quickly.
I tell you what, you get one of those, you just get the airway, don't worry about all this, all right?
That's part two.
That's a part two. All right.
Okay, that's great. So just to signpost the major points: 1, airway management; 2, pre-oxygenation; 3, ventilation; 4, lung mechanics; and 5, uptake of inhalational agents. So those are really the main points after, you know, the definition and the summary statement to answer this question. Good. So thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please rate it and subscribe and share with anyone who's about to sit this exam or simply loves physiology and pharmacology. Catch you next time.